Welcome to MedTalks, a project of the Palm Beach County Medical Society. Thank you for listening to us as we bring you many topics of interest to medicine and our society.
I'm Dr. Brent Schillinger, along with Dr. Abby Strauss, and we're having a conversation today about the ESPRT and its role in curbing the opioid epidemic. We're speaking with Dr. Bertha Madras, who is professor of psychobiology at the Harvard Medical School, and she's director of the Laboratory of Addiction Neurobiology at McLean Hospital. In the public policy arena, Dr. Madras has been appointed on more than one occasion to high-level federal panels. She served as deputy director for demand reduction in the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy in 2006 through 2008. More recently, in 2017, she's been part of the President's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction. Welcome, Dr. Madras.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
ESBRT, screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment. So you've been involved with this for a long time. Tell us how and when did you first connect with the whole ESBRT concept?
I first connected with it in 2006 when I was the deputy drug czar of the country. And I knew there was an ongoing federal program for six states. And I asked SAMHSA and NIDA to come together in my office and just show me what the outcome data was. And the outcome data were spectacularly good at the federal level in terms of six-month follow-up. What I realized over time was that ESBRT is a simplistic term for a very complex set of problems. At that time, we had outcome data for brief interventions and also for referral to treatment. And we had it across the board for different drugs, alcohol, tobacco, marijuana, cocaine, opioids, etc. Our N was close to 500,000 people. And the outcome data at 6 months was that an ESBRT intervention did reduce substance use across the board and also reduce some of the social consequences of substance use in terms of housing, employment, and things like that. But it was only a six-month follow-up, which clearly is not enough. I then traced back what the history of ESBRT was, and it started in 1959 at the Mass General, when one of the physicians went around and found that 20% of the beds were occupied by people with alcohol use disorder. And he began to intervene and try to coach patients to stop risky, problematic drinking. Then it translated into tobacco, and then the ESBRT program at the federal level translated across the board to multiple substances. So that was the origin. My next goal was to try to get billing codes so that physicians could engage in the issue. And the reason, my rationale for that was substance use gives rise to a large conglomerate of adverse health consequences. And therefore, addressing this issue within the medical community should be the norm rather than the exception to the rule. And so I presented the case in front of the CPT board of the American Medical Association. Our first round, they denied the billing codes. Our second round, they accepted them. After I responded to the very simple question, where does it stop with physicians? Chocoholics, jogaholics, sexaholics, gamblingholics, at which point do we really begin to end our medical practice and get involved in habits and addictive behaviors that have nothing to do with medicine? And I said, the boundary is where a addictive behavior gives rise to a medical consequence.
So, you know, our interest locally here in Palm Beach County stems from our drug czar, John Hulick. And he's told us that it was a very powerful tool for him when he was up in New Jersey working under Governor Christie. So the question is, how easy is it to incorporate ESBRT into a primary care setting?
From my perspective, two things have happened this year that are really important. The United States Preventative Services Task Force has strongly recommended that there should be universal screening of adults 18 and over for all illicit drug use, which includes opioids, marijuana, everything. They already had a recommendation for tobacco and alcohol, but now they said this is their final recommendation. With a caveat, and the caveat is a critical one, that if you are going to screen You have to be equipped to know what to do if you get a positive screen. Either you know how to refer a patient to a treatment center, or you are capable of handling their intervention and their treatment yourself. But you cannot screen, get a positive, and then do very little after that. So this just came out June 2020, which was very encouraging to me, because I had been working with the Preventative Task Force for years on trying to shape which direction this should go. And the reason I was trying to shape it is that, for example, with opioids, if a patient screens positive and you're not equipped and willing, for example, to intervene with a medication if they have a very severe addiction, there's no point in finding out except to put it in the record and perhaps alert those who may be in the position of prescribing.
I like the concept. It's just wonderful. And it seems to be a natural extension, a necessary extension of looking at lifestyle changes. For years, physicians really didn't address it. And it to some degree, because it was hard to change them. And it took time. One of the things that, as a psychiatrist, we build these questions into our initial evaluation. But an internist may not have the time to do that. And so what Brent was just talking, getting them to do it, having a CPT code with a payment softens that. Perhaps somebody else can do it. What struck me as I read this is that there was a 2/3 reduction in illicit drug use after 6 months. That's incredible. Two problems pop up. Though you've done a screen, the resources to treat, the community resources to treat, are often very limited. So you have a very good device, but nowhere to send them. So this is the thought that came to my mind as I was creating questions. How many physicians hesitate getting into this because they don't know what to do with it, because there aren't community resources? But number two, maybe simply bringing it up was an intervention. Somebody said, hey, my doc asked about it. That's fantastic.
That is you've really gone to the heart of the matter. One of the main reasons that physicians are worried about screening is that they don't know what to do, because there's been no medical education in 70% of medical schools on what to do with substance use disorders. Period. The CAGE questionnaire was taught and tobacco screening was taught, but very few physicians have ever been trained on how to give motivational interviewing, how to intervene, and so on, let alone the number of physicians who have a DEA waiver to prescribe buprenorphine. They can prescribe naltrexone for opioid addiction, but not buprenorphine unless they have 8 hours of training. And even those physicians who have the 8 hours of training, they underutilize the training dramatically. Very few of them reach the limits in which patients that they're allowed to see. And of those that have the waiver, very few even exercise it. So there are long-term solutions and there are short-term solutions. The long-term solutions is to mainstream this into every medical school, into residency programs. And if you start to interview residents, and this is in the published literature, you find that the ones who have been trained feel much more comfortable dealing with the problem. The real issue comes, what about the physicians who are currently practicing, who never heard it in medical school or residency or in any other venue, and suddenly they're being told to ask questions for which they do not know how to address a positive screen. So that's number one. The second question is the time involved in doing the screening. There's good evidence that the screening can be done on a tablet. The screening can be done on an iPhone. The screening can be done remotely, even from home, before one comes into an office. So that the time involved, and I know the reimbursement for the CPT and the H&G codes is very low, but the time involved for the screening is in fact pretty low. But the third point is, once you have a positive screen. Today, September 2020, not 2030 or 2050, what do you do with a positive screen? And I think there are a few resources that are available through NIDA. NIDA has a website, NIDAMED. SAMHSA has a website which tries to walk physicians through algorithms on what they can say with positive screens. But if the screen is positive and the individual, the patient, turns out to have a frank opioid use disorder, it seems that far more effective than a brief intervention is actually starting them on medications rather than talking to them. And that is not surprising, because once an addiction sets in, the brain is severely neuroadapted in some people, and a 15-minute pep talk or a 10-minute pep talk is not going to really change behavior. It's going to require a lot more. The fourth issue that you raised was whether or not just raising the issue could have an impact. And in fact, some of those studies were done in the 1960s and 70s showing that just asking the questions of a patient changed behavior, even without a brief intervention, even without a motivational form of interviewing. So raising the question is important from many points of view. And I think from the point of view of just good medical practice, knowing what types of drugs the patient is using and how they can confound legitimate prescriptions, how they can confound, exacerbate physical symptoms, all of that is going to be very helpful for physicians in terms of how to treat the full spectrum of issues that a patient presents.
Do you think that part of the reluctance for physicians to get involved in it, part of it may be they've just got so many other things on their plate, and another part of it possibly does it have to do with the stigma of addiction? We know at one time, you go look historically back into the 1920s, physicians wouldn't even see a person if they were an addict.
They wouldn't see them because there were regulations that said, if you try to treat morphine addiction with morphine, you are really violating federal law. That's why we had this vast split between the traditional treatment centers that we have in place now and the medical community, which, other than addiction psychiatry and addiction medicine, the few physicians who've had the courage and resources and grit to engage, there really is a dichotomous world where traditional treatment and traditional medicine rarely meet.
What is your suggestion for changing that, to move in a different direction?
What I'm working on this minute, I have this in front of me, is a paper with the National Academy of Medicine that I'm writing called Transitions of Care and the Weaknesses That We Have in Transitions, from office-based detection to treatment, from rescue, overdose rescue with naloxone, to treatment. And across the board, we have disastrously low quality evidence and or strategies for developing robust transitions. And I'm hoping at some point this paper will be completed. I've been working on it in about a year, that we can begin to shed some algorithms for what to do. Because at this point, what to do is still not clear. I think the first and most important thing is just to develop a list of local treatment centers that have very high-quality, evidence-based practices in treatment. Even if facilities are licensed, the evidence shows that they are very poorly equipped to treat opioid use disorder. Only 5% of the treatment centers in our country can dispense all three medications that are FDA-approved.
doing the screen, and let me say it again for people who have just maybe joined in. It's called Screening Brief Intervention Referral to Treatment. In terms of, especially in psychiatry, is that we do a database that looks for all controlled substances. It helps us. Most people are honest, but some aren't. And you can see something's going on. We have wanted the medical marijuana database to be blended with this other, so we could see that, oh, you're also on medical marijuana. And that becomes an obstacle for us to get information because people don't have to tell us that they're on medical marijuana. It goes to the notion of this is hoping to engage in a realistic, honest manner to find out what's really going on. But can you give us a very brief summary of what does the questionnaire ask?
There are multiple ones. There are about five or six that are evidence-based. And the U.S. Preventative Service Task Force lists all of them. You know, there are certain strengths and weaknesses, but they ask, when do you use marijuana? How often do you use it? Have you had any consequences due to use? And so on and so forth. Marijuana is the elephant in the room. And the reason it's the elephant in the room is that when a person is on medical marijuana, it's become a parallel form of medical service. It's not mainstreamed into most medical practices. The drugs are not FDA approved, and people are, I think the medical marijuana issues undermined medicine, the FDA process, very dramatically. And I'm worried that we're soon going to get a second and third wave with other drugs similar to this, like hallucinogens are coming on board and so on and so forth. My feeling is that one has to treat marijuana, medical or not, in the same category. Because the differences between people using marijuana as a medicine and using it as a recreational drug, the more and more data that come out show there's quite a heavy convergence between the two reasons that are given for using the drug. Yes, some people claim that it alleviates pain, enables them to sleep, and so on. But if you were to alleviate pain and enable person to sleep without the high, I think you'd have far fewer users.
So on that note, when we incorporate SBIRT, is there a big challenge when you're asking patients about their use of illicit drugs? Is there a problem getting them to be honest about something that they may not want to share?
Interestingly, you know, there have been biometric testing to compare patients' verbal answers with what the biometric testing is. The interesting thing is that there's reasonable concordance between the two, except some populations. Pregnant women are less likely to be forthcoming in terms of verbal screening. There are certain individuals who have other substance use problems, and they all are essentially part of the same issue. Some of them are less willing to be forthcoming about polypharmacy. So a person will be willing to discuss alcohol use problems or smoking, but will draw the line when they're asked about others.
Did your research using this screening device, was it used in older folk? We do know there is a tremendous amount of alcoholism in that group. And now, at least around here, the number of my geriatric patients who sooner or later tell me that they got a medical marijuana card,
it's astonishing. Research, to be frank, has not caught up with us yet. The best database we have still is the NISDA survey. And the NISDA survey is showing that marijuana use is through the roof amongst 55-year and older people. We just don't have enough in terms of our screening data, well over a million people from the federal program. A lot of them were not geriatric patients. They were 12 to approximately 50 years old. The problem with the elderly is vast, and combine that with loneliness and lack of social connectedness, I think they're at very high risk for a lot of problems.
You don't have to necessarily, if I understand it correctly, you can leave it, shall we say, a bit open and don't have to say alcohol per se. That's what I liked about it. That's what I thought was interesting.
Yes. We've tried many different, you know, we looked at so much data from different sources. One of the things we looked at was a pre-screen. When was the last time you drank so much that you felt you were out of control? Once a person says that, it's a flag to dig deeper. Because if they say 3 months ago or last week, you know that they're at risk. We tried the same with a single question. When was the last time you used opioids that were not prescribed for you or prescribed for a completely different purpose, but you're using them now? The pre-screening questions can really give you a red flag to pursue more deeply. The second issue that I think piggybacks onto the first is that it's very difficult to find people who have an opioid use disorder that don't have a history of other substance use disorder. Polypharmacy is the norm.
Wouldn't it be an interesting study? I don't know if it's possible, frankly, but it would be interesting to know how many people who have suffered an opioid overdose never had one of these screens.
That's a wonderful question. Absolutely wonderful question. My intuition is that the number of people who've been screened in this country is probably less than 10%. The Mass General implemented screening across the board a while ago, and in fact, to incentivize psychiatrists, they gave them bonuses if they did the screening, just to kickstart it and to motivate them. But with the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommending universal screening for everyone over 18, that is a very important piece of information because it now becomes a quality of care issue if you don't fulfill a recommendation that is a very strong recommendation. It may be an incentive or it may become a financial incentive to have screening. Tom McClellan, who took over my post when President Obama came into office, managed to get screening into the Affordable Care Act. It was one of the quality services. But just saying it's a quality service doesn't mean it's going to happen. But if a preventive service says this is what we recommend across all universal screening, it could be that the insurance companies can begin to engage. There are many ways of putting pressure points on policy, on practice of medicine, which I learned over the years, that can incentivize or disincentivize people. I mean, right now there's a disincentive for unfettered opioid prescribing. There used to be an incentive for it. And I think that the recommendation of the task force could help unite third-party insurers, CMS, and begin to make this not only part of the practice of medicine, but also part of medical education, because that's where the groundwork has to be right now.
And that takes us back to what you mentioned before, though, for this to be truly effective, we have to do more than just a screening. And I'll tell you, one of the projects that Palm Beach County Medical Society has gotten involved with is we set up a whole program separate from the opioids, care coordination, familiar with that whole concept. That's another thing that Medicare and insurance now are paying for care coordinators. So we actually have a program where we've trained, I think, four or five different classes of care coordinators, and we're pushing now to include the whole opioid management as part of care coordination. What is your sense that this would be something very useful?
I think it could be very useful if done properly. What we've learned since the 1960s is that the vast majority of people with severe opioid use disorder, without medications, 80% relapse in a very short period of time after treatment. Care coordination, getting people to match up with people who can do the prescribing, getting people to match up patients with continuum of care, with reinforcement, with housing, employment, all the ancillary services necessary to put people on their feet, I think is essential. We have not had that as part of medicine in the past.
Is it more focused on physicians?
Certainly when I was in office, and I worked on this for a while thereafter, the goal was to train as many people as possible in the screening. including school nurses, social workers, people who, even dentists. I mean, when I say even, you know, one doesn't think of a dentist as being involved in this, and yet we felt dentists could be very critical. We try to cast as broad a net as possible in terms of getting different sectors of the professional healthcare workforce involved in it. The reason that it has moved backwards a bit into the medical community is because of the opioids, for two reasons. One is the necessity for making opioid use disorder on the radar screen of physicians who are prescribing opioids, and were prescribing them with a certain languid sense of non-urgency in the 1990s and 2000s. But secondly, the purpose of engaging more and more of the healthcare community is that with opioid use disorder, there are three medications that are effective. Without medications, the relapse rates are much, much higher. The prescribing of buprenorphine and naltrexone can only be done by physicians or physician assistants and so on. And therefore, the opioids have dragged us back into the healthcare community from casting a broader net.
JAMA August edition focused entirely on opioids and ethics. And the takeaway from that issue to me seemed to be, they kept using this word, we need to aim further upstream if we actually want to make a difference. ESPRT seems to be an important part of that directive. Your thoughts?
What ESPRT can do is be part of prevention. People who criticize ESPRT think that all you need is to give a person a 15-minute pep talk and you're going to reverse their opioid addiction or their alcohol use disorder. And that's just complete science fiction. A very brief intervention is not going to help somebody who has a severe problem. But what ESPRT does is, by raising the issue within a medical community, it alerts the patient to a very simple fact that drugs are dangerous for health, and physicians are engaged in trying to warn you and prevent substance use. ESPRT also can alert physicians that their patients are at risk, going upstream by screening, by finding out, just excavating the information. I have a very sweet anecdote, if there's a moment of time. I once presented the whole concept of ESPRT to a very, very high government official, someone within the government service, but not within the core cabinet or any of the top officials. And the response to me was, what business is it for physicians to ask about our private lives? That person did not last very long, but that's not the take-home message was that I once described this episode to two very, very well-known psychiatrists in the country over dinner. And they both looked at me and said, you know why you were asked that question, don't you? I said, of course I do. Because they had a problem and they didn't want anybody to probe it.
Or let me put it this way, it may mitigate or dilute or reduce some of the stigma and shame because it becomes a normal part of the medical evaluation. Again, I'll go back then to the word, it normalizes it. It doesn't make it eccentric or odd or nefarious.
Abby, that's exactly right. Because by asking, you normalize. By normalizing, you reduce the stigma from the physician and from the patient, and the shame of the patient. Because the physician looks at a patient with a straight face, not with a wagging finger, not with condemnation, but with a straight face, and says, for your health, it is so important for me to know what substances you are using, because they may interfere with the medication I'm prescribing. They may be responsible for your diabetes getting worse. They may be responsible for the fact that you're not sleeping well or having trouble at work. it's important for me to know and to try to help you. And without being judgmental, and training physicians not to be judgmental, you can lower the level of stigma, both from the perspective of the physician as well as the perspective of the patient.
I have a final question here. In looking at the research you do in the psychobiology sphere, you've done a lot of work looking at the effects of drugs on brain development.
Yes.
And how early initiators are more susceptible to addiction. How does SBIRT fit in this preventive approach?
It's a very beautiful question, and I wish I had enough time to answer it. My feeling is, the U.S. Preventative Task Force said 18 and over because there wasn't enough evidence on asking these questions with regard to an adolescence and pre-adolescence. The research that I'm doing now, we just published this in JAMA Network Open a few months ago, is that parents have the most critical influence on whether or not their children are going to use drugs. I made the recommendation in the paper, and I made it in another paper that I wrote, that pediatricians should raise the issue with parents. Are you using at home in front of your kid? Are you normalizing use? Are you discussing the negative consequences of drugs with your children? Because you have about the most important influence on your children's substance use. There's papers that show that if peers use, parents' disapproval can surmount peer pressure to use. And what we found, this was Samson Nida, the CDC, and myself, we three agencies and myself just collaborated on this paper. We found that if parents had used even in their lifetime, but not in the past year, that their lifetime use was a risk factor for their children using. They had normalized use perhaps as teenagers, as college students, and so on. And because of that, somehow they were more tolerant of their children using. We don't know the exact answers.
So many factors at play. Dr. Bertha Madras, Harvard psychobiologist, thank you so much for this informative conversation.
Thank you. It was a pleasure meeting both of you, and I hope it helps. Thank you. Bye-bye.